podcast from Literary Hub, where we believe that nearly every issue that shows up in your Twitter feed or the evening news has already been tackled somewhere in literature. On each episode, we'll bring you not only the news, but also reading chosen to shed some light on the subject at hand. I'm Sugi Ganeshanandan.
I'm Sugi's co-host, Whitney Terrell. So, all right, look, I never thought I'd say this, but one of the cool things about starting this podcast, this is now our fourth episode, has been the analytics. You've been looking at those?
Yeah, I'm a data nerd too, and I'm excited that our listeners are really international. We've got a lot of listeners in the UK, in Canada, Australia, and we also, to my surprise, have a presence in places like France, Hong Kong, Spain, Thailand, and Germany.
All right, so one point we're bringing that up because I want to remind people to review us on iTunes or Stitcher, which is how other listeners find us, but also because we don't have listeners in Russia. But that country seems totally omnipresent in American news and politics these days. In our last episode, we talked about Russian-sponsored dark ads. We've talked about, and you know, the Russians are leaking emails during the election from Hillary Clinton, the Democratic Party. We got Robert Mueller looking into connections between the Trump campaign and the Russians.
And so, of course, because we're FNF, this made us think of Russian writers. So in the second half of today's show, we're going to talk to my colleague Charlie Baxter about America's ongoing fascination with 19th century Russian literature. But first, we're going to talk to Ukrainian-born writer Sana Krasikov, whose new novel, The Patriots, is set in America and in Russia during the Cold War. Sana, welcome to the show.
Good to be here, Sugi.
Both The Patriots and your 2008 story collection, one where you're focused on characters whose lives connect Russia and its neighbors to America. But I can't imagine that while you were writing, you could have anticipated the current news situation. And I'm just wondering what that's been like to watch and think about your book coming out in this atmosphere.
Yeah, so The Patriots was actually published 4 days after the inauguration. And it was odd because my publisher had pushed it till after the election, thinking that it would just be a more calm time and less the news cycle wouldn't be quite so insane. And of course it was the opposite. But you know, I everyone's asked me like, oh, you couldn't have anticipated it. I have to say, honestly, I mean, I was a little surprised, but not as much as some people. I actually thought Trump would have a fairly good chance of winning. You know, being just kind of hearing what I do from out of the Russian community. But the other thing is, you know, I'd started the book in 2008, right, when we'd basically plunged into this worldwide economic recession, and I had been really delving into the 30s when the book begins. And, you know, like my husband has this joke that, you know, if you look at, you know, a time when you had a prolonged economic crisis and you had, you know, inflamed class anxiety, racial tension, political polarization, and then, you know, you have a new form of media that's broadcasting all this outrage. And after all of that, basically you get a, you know, a president who's a scion of a wealthy New York family who's championing himself, the champion of the working class, and then promptly develops an uncritical friendship with Russia's strongman leader. Like, we would think we were talking about today and we'd be off by about 80 years because all of this happened in some form already. The political polarization, the nativist rhetoric, like, those were really flourishing in the 30s. You had people like who were basically like mastering this blend of hyperbole and humor and outrage that, and broadcasting it through the radio. I mean, you had the most popular order at the time.
So radio like stands in for what, Facebook and Twitter now?
Yeah, totally. I mean, people talked about the dangers of the radio the way that they talked about the dangers of Facebook. And you
as we did last podcast, just to say.
You did, right. And, you know, you have people like Senator Huey Long, who ran for office. You had,
Father Coughlin, wasn't he?
Coughlin was the really big one. And, you know, also the press kind of dismissed these people as backwater quacks, you know, but they were getting huge swaths of support from middle-class America, right? Not necessarily just the poor and downtrodden. You know, really felt like Marx's predictions were coming true. They called it the crisis of capitalism. People were leaving America. You know, workers were returning to their home countries. People were going to Moscow like it was, you know, the new Jerusalem. If you want to talk about a schizophrenic relationship with Russia, I mean, we didn't even recognize Russia until FDR came to power. So we didn't, we had no diplomatic relationship with them. The press kept beating the drum against the Red Menace. Why? Meanwhile, we were make America was brokering million-dollar deals with them on a regular basis.
Right, and that's all important in the book. I really love those parts. You know, that connection of trade, the way you talk about trade and the way the trade relationship between Russia and America is working at that particular timeline. But I wanted to ask you about some other parallels.
Sure.
You know, I was thinking about, when I was preparing for this, I was thinking about Gary Steingart's novel Absurdistan, which came out in 2006. And he has a line in it: "The Soviet Union is gone and the borders are as free and passable as they've ever been. And yet, when a Russian moves between two universes, this feeling of finality persists. The logical impossibility of a place like Russia existing alongside the civilized world of Ann Arbor, Michigan, sharing the same atmosphere with, say, Vladivostok." That is very different than people wanting to move to Moscow as they did in the 30s, right? I mean, you were in the U.S. then. Did you feel that way?
Actually, I was in Russia when I read that line. My friend and I ordered the book so we could share it. It's a beautiful original phrase by Gary Steingart. What it comes down to for me is that there's this kind of unseemly gap between cause and effect that can take place. When you're in Russia, like, the things that you could be punished or rewarded for don't always have a one-to-one concurrence. I mean, which is why sometimes when you're reading or writing about Russia, it feels like science fiction. I mean, in fact, their most popular kind of genre is science fiction. Probably some of my favorite Russian writers, like Pelevin, are science fiction writers because they capture that. But, you know, there were other writers like Dostoevsky who wrote about it, this idea of proizvol, that there's no kind of one-to-one relationship between cause and effect. The writer who's currently working, who I think really captured it, is Yelena Kostuchenko. She's a journalist for Novaya Gazeta, and she really goes into rural Russia, and she comes up with these vignettes that almost feel like science fiction. So, you know, she had this really small story about this policeman who saw a young woman drowning in freezing November water, and he dives in to save her while his superior yells at him not to disobey him and jump in. And then he saves her, and he's given a demotion and stripped of his bonus because he's left his holster and gun on the bank of the river. What's happening is that the laws of the state and society aren't matching up.
I think it does seem like in the past year, the change is on a different level. Michigan actually voted for Trump. So is that, is that a way to think about the state and society? I mean, I don't know what it means that Michigan voted for Trump. I live in Michigan, and that frankly broke my heart. Trump and much of his entourage are connected to Russia, and Paul Manafort's been indicted, and these kind of mini oligarch characters that Steingart satirizes in that book, you know, are they now in charge of the U.S. government? How comfortable do you feel thinking about like the personality types that you're describing and that I think maybe Americans associate with Russia?
I mean, one of your questions seems to be like, are we becoming more Russianized in our relationship with the state?
Yes.
I'm not as alarmist about that as some people. I don't think so. I've asked Russians about it, and the answer that I get is that, you know, when the travel ban came out and you had a state judge who declared it unconstitutional, I mean, Russians said to me that the minute that a judge from some province declares something that Vladimir Putin is doing illegal, we will no longer be Russia. So I don't think we're even close, actually.
Oh, good.
But, you know, I think there is a particular way that we are becoming more mm-hmm. similar, and that has to do with, in the nerdy way to put it, is our lack of faith in institutions. In the more fun way to put it, is our how much more time and space we give conspiracy theories.
Oh my goodness!
Political discourse.
Well, I mean, speaking of that, I mean, that's one of the things that. I mean, so you may say that you know, the larger government in terms of the court system is working, but our president and Vladimir Putin are buddies, at least in Trump's mind. You know, they just met over the weekend. They were wearing the same clothes, you know.
I take a little bit of issue with that.
Okay, good.
I don't think Trump did give Russians what they wanted, which is, if not the lifting of sanctions, then at least encouraging Europe to lift the sanctions. I'm not sure. I'm like the last person who wants to give Trump too much credit, but I don't think he actually played into the snare, if there was one, so much. But I do think there is an affinity between the two men. I think, you know, it's interesting because so I'm just going to go back to this FDR-Stalin comparison for a minute, because I think there's two things about it that are useful to think about.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a really brief summary of the book is that it's basically about a group of Americans who get...
the Patriots you're talking about now.
Right, Patriots. It's about a group of Americans who end up in Russia, and then the path back to them is closed. And they are sort of forced to reckon with this world that's changing and see it through American eyes and kind of navigate this brave new world as Americans. And the reason they can't go back does not entirely have to do with Soviet machinations. It also has to do with this relationship that Russia and America have, kind of this deal that they've brokered, that these people basically are sacrificed to this deal. And on one hand, you know, it's understandable that someone like FDR did not want to rock the boat when he needed Stalin as a strategic ally against fascism, right? The way that we're talking about terrorism right now, that, you know, when Trump says, well, if they're going to spend millions of dollars bombing ISIS, I have no problem with that. The other thing is, I think just as then, there was actually kind of a more genuine admiration that the two men had for each other. And we're talking about a world where a lot of the history that we know now wasn't necessarily written about, or if it was written about, like, you know, the fact that they're starving their people was just called fake news back in the 30s. But I think there was the project of lifting up your people, right? Like, our people, the people were in poverty in both nations, and you had to kind of have a strong arm to lift them up. And both countries were engaging in this huge social engineering project. And I think I think FDR kind of admired Stalin for that, and vice versa. And I think it's the same sort of admiration that we're seeing today. I guess none of it was that weird to me, having
I don't think it's weird. I just worry about the kinds of things that Trump admires in Putin are not the same ones that you're talking about that FDR admired in Stalin. I mean, I think he likes him for his sort of anti-democratic tendencies, for the way that he is not really supportive of a free press, you know, the way that he's willing to use racial animosity to sort of, you know, consolidate rule. I mean, all those things, you know, are at play and seem to be, to me, really negative.
Well, I won't argue with that. I think at this point, you know, Russia's attempt to affect, you know, our election isn't disputed, but I nonetheless feel like our attempt to try to delegitimize an unpopular president by saying that Russia kind of caused him to triumph, to me, that's sort of the other side of the conspiracy thinking coin. Even if they did all those things, like, nobody forced people to go into the voting booths and vote the way they did. I mean, that's on us. Like, if we want to reckon with our choices, then we have to reckon with our choices. But this attempt to sort of delegitimize the other side, you know, never before in our history have we had so much to a press sort of dedicated to things that were not necessarily unfactual, but like pseudo-factual or unknowns. And like, that does remind me in a way of Russia. I mean, conspiracy thinking basically takes the place of actual political discourse over there. I mean, people just love their conspiracy theories. And I think there's a number of reasons for that, but people really pride themselves on the sophistication of their cynicism over there. Like, you're not a sucker if you believe in nothing, right? And
I'm working so hard on my cynicism now, I feel bad.
Well, no, it's like you have. So it's funny. It's like so part of the. I was living in Russia in 2008, and a lot of what's in the novel kind of came wholesale out of the mouths of just people I talked to. And the one kind of conversation that you always end up having when you've drank enough is, well, everything, you know, yes, you know, yes, we're a Potemkin village, but so are you. You know, you don't actually have a free press. That's a joke. Your judges are all appointed. I mean, they kind of go, and they, you know, you have this imitation cheese democracy, just like Russia's. So I had this scene where basically someone's at this, the son of the main character who comes back to Russia to figure out kind of what happened to her to get his son out of the country. He's at this business banquet, and his the businessmen he's working with are kind of ribbing him about this. And, you know, they're like, oh, 9/11, you know, my real question is what happened to the other planes? Because, you know, there were seven of them. And then what really surprised me, but I put it in anyway, was they didn't seem to spare Putin from this, their conspiracy theorizing. And this is people who work for basically a state-backed company. Like, so when my friend who told me the story said, well, you know, what about the fact that you guys bombed those apartment buildings so you could bring your troops back into Chechnya? He's like, well, of course we did it. You know, he's the guy's basically accusing his own president of being a terrorist. And this is a Putin patriot. So, like, what was going on? Like, I couldn't figure it out. It occurred to me that this wasn't, this kind of cynicism that I saw there wasn't just a byproduct of having information that's not reliable. I actually think it's a sort of cynicism by design, that, you know, if you have no faith in any institution that can say stop the FSB bombing a building, then what you're saying is, you know, only one person, which is the person at the top, is in charge. But for those people who are kind of proud of the fact that they believe in nothing, even if they say, oh, yeah, you know, we orchestrated our own an act of terror in order to re-enter a war, it still actually says that Putin's the only one in charge. Like, and at the same time, you don't sound like you're a sucker. So it's funny. It's a cynicism that kind of serves the state. And I thought about that, and I thought about how here there was something similar happening, that if you, you know, if one side is saying, oh, no, there's a deep state that's preventing, and there's this deep state that's, you know, undermining the president and trying to topple our own government, or if you're even saying, hey, the Russians put Trump in power, you're sort of saying a variation on that, that, you know, your cynicism is actually underwriting your own form of patriotism. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, that makes perfect sense. I mean, it sounds from a certain point of view, I mean, It sounds like some Sri Lankans I know. I mean, I don't think I can claim that I have a pulse on the, like, a really broad section of the community, but there are certainly people who, right? I mean, the idea that you don't believe in anything and therefore you're not a sucker. The way that can actually kind of lead to a kind of stagnant view of politics.
Right.
And also what you're saying about, yeah, like the. Yeah, exactly. And, like, also the decay of certain institutions of the state that ought to be operating as checks on justice, like whether it's the judiciary or, you know, I think going back to what you said earlier about us having to be accountable for our own votes, like, I think in the case of the United States, like, the really clear decline of public education.
Well, so, it's a significant Republican project to defund education, at least in my state.
Exactly. And I think that, like, I don't think I'm as surprised as other people that Trump won. And from a certain point of view, like, I guess, I don't know, I feel like sort of already past that surprise.
Yeah, right. We're a long way in.
I think, yeah, and which I think I associate that lack of surprise also with, like, communities of color that I'm in touch with, where people are sort of like, come on, this was here all along. Or sort of, I mean, even, you know, we did an episode on the Weinstein allegations, and then there's this kind of burst of surprise, often from men who are kind of like, I didn't know that all of this was going on, and women who are sort of like, of course it was going on all along. There's this part in The Patriots where Alyosha Alkakhol claims that his hero is Ralph Ellison. The invisible man is a cipher, he claims. He lives in a basement full of light bulbs, siphoning off electricity from the monopolized energy company. The utility company is unaware of his existence, as if the fraudulent state whose authority he does not recognize. Like the invisible Negro, I choose to have no existence in the eyes of our illegitimate state, which strikes me as, like, basically exactly what you're saying.
So there's plenty of people like that. And I think in Russia, there's actually a term for them, which would be internal emigre, that, you know, you kind of drop out of the public sphere and you lead a rich interior life, which, I mean, one thing that Russian immigrants have often bemoaned as they've immigrated is that the interior life of people in their new country is just not as rich, and they're And it's, there's, they have a point, but I think people develop that, often can develop that to compensate for the fact that they don't feel like they can change much, you know, in the public sphere. And it actually makes me think of this quote from Elizabeth Gilbert in the sixth page of Eat, Pray, Love. And forgive me, guys, I do love my Elizabeth Gilbert, but she was talking about why the Italians have the best meatballs. They were like, well, you know, if you can't change your bureaucracy, at least you can make the best meatball in the world. So I think of it as like the best meatball effect.
So after all this, I mean, you may not have been surprised by Trump's election and the wall-to-wall coverage of the Russia story, but has it changed how you think about your own writing? Has it changed how people react to you? It's a sort of different environment in which to be writing about the things that you are writing about.
I think the reason people did say, wow, a lot of this feels familiar, wasn't just because Russia was in the news, because a lot of the ideas that have always been there that I was trying to explore are suddenly under the spotlight. I think you can't help it as a writer in a modern age when you're trying to like grapple genuinely with a historical subject of thinking about projecting our own experience on it. And so I like that. I mean, I like that it's sort of this parallel universe where the rules are slightly different, but you get to think about your very current subjects.
Sana, it's so great to have you on the show, especially because I'm remembering that, you know, a dozen years ago in grad school, we were in a class on the Russians, and it's wonderful to have you on the show with us today. Thank you so much for doing this.
Great talking to you, Siggy. Good talking to you, Whit. Good luck, guys, and looking forward to hearing it.
Thanks a lot for being on the podcast, Sana.
All right. Talk soon. Bye.
Okay. I'm thrilled to say that our next guest is Charles Baxter. Charles, thanks so much for doing this and welcome to the show. And I can't wait to hear what you think about Russian writers.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
So last night I was on a train from Dresden to Berlin, and I was traveling with a Russian-American friend of mine, Aglaya Glebova, who is at the American Academy with me. And by coincidence, we got into a section with some Russian travelers and started playing cards with them. So I was telling them about the podcast. And when I told them that Americans read and love Russian classics, one of them in particular said that she was astonished that Russians don't really read or love American writers in what she thought was a comparable way. And she was surprised that given what was going on in the news that Russian literature held this place in the American imagination. She wanted to know why.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is obviously a really complicated question. And when I was talking to a friend about it last night, one of the things she said was, how do you talk about soul, S-O-U-L? And, you know, I think one of the things that Americans love about Russian writers, particularly Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, is that they're so good at describing interior, emotional, and spiritual and psychic states and conditions. And I think American writers used to be, I don't know if there's so much that way now, but they used to be shy about that. And the Russians are not.
And you also write about Chekhov a lot in Burning Down the House. I wondered if you could just read a passage from that book for us.
Okay, sure. This is from Burning Down the House, and it's from an essay in that book about Uncle Vanya. We can call it, in honor of one of its first diagnosticians, the Chekhov problem, which goes something like this. What does one do actively with one's honest revulsion and disgust with the cruelties, lies, and deceptions of middle-class life? Chekhov's response to this challenge, and this is a gross oversimplification, is to show that hidden under the outward mimes of character, there lies the substance of real character, a kind of essence. Something genuine, sooner or later, will show itself. All we need to do is wait, observe, and hold on to those moments whenever they arrive. In this way, weariness and cynicism are kept at arm's length, because no character can be wholly co-opted by any system. Some particle of the genuine will emerge at some point.
Thanks so much, Charlie. I think in reading Burning Down the House, which is this craft classic, now as I think about how to write fiction in the face of a changing political climate, passages like this read differently to me. I mean, they're about morality and ideas and their intersection with craft. And I can't help but read that last bit about no character can be wholly co-opted by any system and think, do I still believe that?
Yeah, I wonder about that too. There's an interesting story of Chekhov's called In the Ravine. It's not one that automatically gets taught the way The Lady and the Pet Dog does. And in that story, there is a kind of catastrophic ecological disaster occurring to a small Russian town. And a character in that story who is so possessed by greed that she and there's a sense in which there's no genuine self there. All she is a personification of greed. And I once tried to talk about that story at a small southern college where the students were very conservative, and they hated the story. They didn't like the news that it brought, and they said it was very un-Chekhovian.
Oh, interesting.
And I said, you must be kidding. Chekhov wrote it. No, it's not like his work at all, they said. And one of the students in class said to me, unless the story was signed by Chekhov, I wouldn't have believed that he did it.
So what did they think a Chekhov story was supposed to be?
I think they thought it was supposed to be a kind of slightly gray-colored account of middle class life lived with great subtlety. I don't think they were expecting a story in which the forces of competition, money, and commerce had been brought into play. And, you know, I told them that Chekhov wrote a nonfiction account of the island, the prison camp on the island of Sakhalin.
Yeah.
And they didn't want to believe me about that either. it's just not the image that a lot of Americans have of Chekhov, this other side of him.
So you think what makes people comfortable about him, I mean, in some places, I don't think that writers teach him for this reason, but maybe other readers are comfortable with him because they recognize middle-class life in his stories? I mean, for me, one of the things that I liked about Russian writers is slightly different. It's not a class thing. It's a space thing. In other words, mm-hmm. if somebody from the Midwest, like in Turgenev, for instance, you know, in Fathers and Sons, like the idea of coming home from college to a sort of rural area where, you know, or the isolation and separation from the capitals, which is also present in Chekhov's stories sometimes, really was meaningful to me. It felt like the world that I'd come out of.
Right. Well, I think one of the things that's interesting about Chekhov's stories is that in many of those tales, and in the plays too, particularly, characters have been given almost everything that, at least in America, you would assume would make them happy. They have an adequate income, they're reasonably civilized, they have all of the features of life that we believe should create contentment, and yet they're not happy, and they are often articulate about why they're not happy. And, you know, Chekhov is very smart about what happens to people who have too much leisure time and not enough of a too much leisure time and not enough of a sense of what their lives should actually contain. They don't feel a sense of mission, and they don't know what they should be doing with their lives. I think that resonates with a lot of Americans.
There's a Twitter account called, I think it's called Guy in Your MFA, and it sort of tweets cliches about MFA programs, and some of them are sort of things like, you know, quiet, it's sort of malaise, I guess, is the word that people often invoke. Jesus, and a lot of the tweets represent that. And it's funny to I hadn't really thought about it in terms of Chekhov as being a source of that. But I mean, of course it is. I guess the word that I just use is different.
The other thing about Chekhov that has always struck me is that, and this is something that our students in MFA programs are slow to learn how to do because it's so hard, it's so complicated, is how to compound emotions so that any particular character is feeling two or three different emotions, some of them contradictory emotions at the same time. Uncle Vanya is full of that, and so are a number of the stories. But yes, you know, I think American life has this feature that many of us are lucky and many of us have, maybe not so much anymore, but at one time we had all of the sufficient features that a good life was supposed to contain, and yet nobody was happy. I mean, there's a whole subspecies of American literature in the 1950s that was all about this. Richard Yates and John Cheever, right, just to name two, were great writers on this particular subject.
Maybe we're kind of moving out of our Chekhov period and into more of our Dostoevsky period.
Yeah, exactly
how
right.
People are going to think.
Exactly right.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, I was sitting on this train playing cards, losing at cards, actually losing specifically at this game called Dixit to these Russian friends and my Russian speaking friend who was with me. And they were talking about what they read when they were kids or when they were in school about America. And I was telling them what I had read, you know, and Americans really read classic Russian literature. We love Master and Margarita. We love Chekhov, Anna Karenina, War and Peace, The Brothers Karamazov, which I think I read that in high school AP English. And these friends who were educated in Russia were racking their brains to think of which Americans they'd read. They were working pretty hard, and the range was fairly narrow. So, you know, one of them mentioned Steinbeck because, quote unquote, America sucks too. And, you know, she mentioned that Lenin died listening to his wife read Jack London. And I asked her, you know, why would Jack London be appealing specifically to Lenin? She was sort of like, well, you know, I think my guess was that, you know, nature and it's cold and rough out there and we have sympathy for that. So Jack London. They didn't seem to necessarily know that they had such a hold on American readers and American education about literature.
Right. Well, you know, I can't really speak for the Russians, but if I were forced to come up with a comment about why this is true, I think that what I would say is that for Russians, the experience of the revolution, the years under Stalin, the Great Terror, and then World War II, and the years under Khrushchev, and the gradual falling away of the great socialist experiment, all of this was historically so traumatic for them that if I had been a Russian during that period, I would be completely absorbed with that passage of historical forces, and looking at American literature, if I had lived through that or I had that as part of my historical background, I would just think, you know, American literature has nothing to do with me. It has, it's almost as if the world of American literature is science fiction, even when it's being realistic. science fiction to Russians. Although I will tell you this story, that when Gorbachev was still a premier of the last premier of the Soviet Union, he came to St. Paul, Minnesota. And one of the things he wanted was a first edition of Sinclair Lewis's Main Street, which he had read in Russian as a boy. And so, you know, I think that some of the American village novelists and short story writers like Sherwood Anderson, Sinclair Lewis, were widely read in the Soviet Union. And you know, Americans probably read more Russians than the Russians read Americans. Everybody read Nabokov. I mean, if you consider him Russian, which I think we have to, but the Russian writer everybody's reading now is Svetlana Alexievich, who's essentially a nonfiction writer.
Yeah. I mean, I just want to emphasize how I just remember, I mean, The Brothers Karamazov was the first book that I ever read that like questioned the religious beliefs that I had been brought up in an interesting way. You know, like,
right.
I went to a Russian writer for that. And it was only because I found it. It was just on my parents' shelf. You know, I took it down, I read it, but it immediately spoke to me. But I realized that I don't read contemporary Russian writers. You know, do you know anything about what's happening in terms of contemporary Russian fiction?
I have a friend who does read Russian and who gave me the names of a number of Russian writers, contemporary Russian writers, and whose work I checked on. There was a guy, Valentin Rasputin, who I actually met at a literary conference. Very unpleasant. Very unpleasant guy, a right winger, but he, interestingly, he's opposed to industrialization. He's a kind of madcap ecologist who is being driven crazy, or was when I knew him, by the pollution of Lake Baikal. The answer to your question is I really am not up on my contemporary Russian writers, except for Gary Steingart, who writes in English.
Right. And you mentioned Svetlana Alexievich.
Is it just because they're not getting translated, do you think, Sugi? I mean,
this is what I was wondering. I mean, right, because this was one of the things that struck me on the train talking to these folks, is that, you know, Americans read so little in translation as compared to other folks. And then, like in other countries, there's so much in translation. I can't say that I was familiar with Svetlana Alexievich's work before she won the Nobel. But when we say, like, everybody is reading her, who do we mean? Like, is she being taught in literature classes? I don't know how much she's being read.
Yeah. A typical failing of a literary critic to think that everybody's reading the stuff I'm reading. I think the reason that so many people in this country have been interested in her is that one of her books, Voices from Chernobyl, is about, of course, the catastrophe at Chernobyl and the possible catastrophes produced by nuclear power. And another one of her books is called Zinky Boys, which is about the aftermath of the Russian incursion into Afghanistan. And so, of course, that has relevance for us.
Yeah.
I think we should also put a call out to our listeners. If they have good suggestions, write them in on our Facebook page or on Twitter, and we'll talk about them in a later episode.
As I was reading Burning Down the House and rereading it and thinking about this episode, there's just a ton of references to Chekhov and to Tolstoy and to, you know, Russian writers. And yet I don't know that I actually know what you think about reading through this lens of Nation.
I don't know. It's a great question, and I'm not exactly sure how to answer it, except by saying that I think I first started reading Russian writers when I was in eighth or ninth grade. I think I read an abridged edition of Crime and Punishment just because I liked the title.
It's a great title.
But I always felt much more at home reading Russian writers than I ever did reading, you know, English novelists like Thackeray and Trollope, or even Dickens for that matter. I mean, the moodiness of Russian literature appealed to me immediately when I was an adolescent. And I, you know, if you forced me into a corner and asked me, you know, one of the handful of my favorite novels, I would say The Master and Margarita. So, you know, the question of nationality, you know, it's a tricky one, but it also has to do with the way as readers we find our own homes. And I just always found myself feeling comfortable reading Turgenev and Chekhov and Dostoevsky, and even the poets, Anna Akhmatova, whose work I just loved. So I don't know. I think sometimes the boundaries of national literature do melt down when you start reading, particularly as an adolescent.
I so felt that way. I mean, I so agree. I do remember the only way I could get through Crime and Punishment, though, was that I listened to it on tape driving between Iowa City and Kansas City over a period of like a year.
And you asked before about translation, Whit, and I just was thinking, Sana, who was on the first half of the podcast, she and I took a class with Zizi Packer about that was Russian writers when we were in graduate school. And for a lot of the semester, I had maybe never read anything in translation before that, hadn't really even thought about it. And I got the book out of the library and I got the wrong translation. And it was I was having this completely joyless experience because I was reading a translation that was, I think, really bad.
One essay I was writing, I was really interested in the last speech that Sonia gives in Uncle Vanya. And
yeah, I was going to bring that up.
Yeah.
And it really makes a difference to have a friend who can read Russian and who can tell you exactly what the words, not only what they mean, but what they connote and what the overtones of that speech are. Because it's a very complicated speech and it's not at all clear that Sonia believes what she's saying, or she's just saying these things to reassure her uncle and then maybe to reassure herself. And Russians are always telling you that some of their writers, such as Platonov, are more or less untranslatable, that you just aren't going to get it if you can't read Russian. You're not going to get what his prose does. I always feel at a bit of a disadvantage reading particularly Dostoevsky in translation, because Russians will say, well, it's very funny. And I don't get that.
That was the only way I got the funny part of Crime and Punishment was listening to it. The guy who read it made it funny. And I had not understood that. I never got it from reading it.
Right. Neither had I.
Well, this makes me want to go get audiobooks and also study some Russian. Charlie, thanks so much for being on the show. It's a real treat. And we recommend Charlie Bachtor's fiction to you, of course. And also, we've been referencing Burning Down the House, which is his collection of craft essays, which is full of Chekhovian and examples and citations and lots of references to terrific short stories. Charlie, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Thanks so much for being on the show.
Hi, I'm JJ Cantrell, the new host of In the Stacks. This week, we're talking to writer and bookstore owner Ashley Warlick. Ashley's co-owner of M. Judson Bookstore in downtown Greenville, South Carolina. Her latest book is The Arrangement, an absolutely beautiful historical novel about food writer MFK Fisher. Ashley, what novels can you recommend to us this week that would give us a better insight into our topic?
The first book that I thought of when we started talking about this was Colin McCann's Dancer, which is a book that came out probably 5 or 6 years ago that is based on the life of the Russian ballet dancer Rudolf Nureyev. And it's just got this gorgeous structure to it. It's told in a kaleidoscope of voices from Nureyev himself, you know, through the most insignificant passing characters that might have a point of view on his life. But in the meantime, this picture of mid-century Russia really comes to life in a way that reminds you of Tolstoy, but in a completely contemporary feeling novel. Obviously, I thought of the Gary Sheingart novel, Super Sad True Love Story, Russian Debutante Handbook, which, while giving a picture of Russia, also give a picture of a Russian immigrant story to this country, and are often funny and bizarre and complicated in the way that, you know, they're the sort of Russian ancestral roots might be. As a bookseller in the last year or so, I've seen some pretty interesting turns towards this subject matter as well. So about a year ago, Penguin came out with a beautiful new edition of The Master and Margarita, which is a book, you know, sort of brings this Russian classic to a new audience. And if you haven't read that book, it's really funny, which is something that I don't know that we necessarily associate with our picture of Russian literature. It's bizarre, too. I mean, magical realism that's in The Master and Margarita really, it's got nothing on what, you know, what Marquez was doing later. But even just like a couple weeks ago, Janet Fitch came out with a historical novel called The Revolution of Marina M. And of course, Janet Fitch is pretty famous for her, you know, Oprah Book Club. You know, so she's really bringing this picture of a young woman involved in the Russian Revolution and that part of Russian history, bringing that to a very different audience than your typical readers of Chekhov and Tolstoy and the Brothers Karamazov.
Ashley, these are great recommendations. Thank you so much.
And that's it for this week's episode of the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast. Whitney and I will be back with a new episode in 2 weeks. Our theme music is composed by Travis Workman. You can subscribe to us in iTunes, on Apple Podcasts, through Stitcher, through Audioboom, or at the Literary Hub website. So I'm also going to remind you that you can like our Facebook page at FNF Pod or leave us a review on iTunes or follow us on Twitter at FNF Talk. That will make it easier for other listeners to find us and also for you to tell us which Russians you're reading.